Recovery Today on UKHealthRadio.com. Join me and my guests on this voyage of recovery and discovery.
Well, hello everyone. My name is Jim Smith and welcome to Recovery Today. Well, this week's show, it's another old friend. I mean, most people I'm interviewing in this series are friends. But and Reg is an old friend. And the great thing about you, Reg, I've always admired is we don't see a lot of each other, but when we do, there's always new projects on the horizon or things that you're involved in. And it kind of mirrors my life to an extent. So I really identify with that. Anyway, Reg, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jim. Very glad to be here.
And I don't actually know about your origins, so maybe you could tell our listeners where it all began for you, where you grew up. And you know.
Well, I'm an EastEnder. My parents told me I was a Cockney. They told me that with pride.
Right.
But I had an art director who said, "You're not a Cockney, you're an Essex boy." Oh. Because I was born in Barking.
Yeah.
I'm a war baby. I was born on the 10th of September 1940, when the Blitz had just started.
Yeah.
And my son, who's a journalist, tells me that on that particular night, there was the most terrible disaster, civil disaster, where some... up to 600 people were killed in the East End of London.
Good heavens.
And it was suppressed afterwards. But yes, I was never told that.
No.
And I was totally unconscious of that. The nurses called me. I was born during an air raid.
Really?
And I was nicknamed Bomber by I don't know if this has any relevance at all to anything, but that's what I was told by my mum. And my father worked for a guy called Reginald Kennedy Cox, and he started the Docklands Settlements.
Oh,
and
yes.
He said to my parents, if your next child is a son, will you name him after me? Because he was a bachelor and unlikely to have children.
Yes.
And so I'm named after him, and he was my benefactor.
Oh.
So what that meant was I went to a private school. So from the East End of London, sounded like something out of EastEnders.
Yes.
I went to a private school where I was considered not good enough.
Right.
So right from, and I was sent away to school at 7. And when I've done hypnotherapy and gone back in my life, the point that I get to, which is the tricky bit, always is the same.
Yeah.
7 years old, standing outside this red brick building with my father and my brother, and knowing I was going to be left there.
That's incredible.
And I couldn't understand it.
So, well, 7 is very symbolic, isn't it, to many cultures? You know, is it the Christian Brothers or they show me the boy of 7 and I'll show you the man? It's quite...
I know the Jesuits were.
The Jesuits,
had
sorry.
Had some idea that if we can get you early, we've got you for life.
That's right. So where was this school? Was it out of, obviously out of London?
It was out of London. Oh. It was in Salisbury.
Salisbury,
it was called Chaffin Grove, and there was nothing much wrong with it. It's just that I wasn't right for it.
No, no.
I was not a middle-class posh boy.
No, no.
I was a working-class kid who'd been dropped in. There was actually a film years ago called The Guinea Pig, and it had Richard Attenborough in it.
I've seen that.
And he played a working-class kid.
He did.
I think he got a scholarship.
Yeah, that's right.
In my case, I had... Reginald Kennedy Cox in United, Sir Reginald Kennedy Cox, who was my benefactor. But, you know, the maths master who eventually committed suicide when he was found to be a paedophile.
Good hands.
Not that he was ever bad to me. But he'd gone through the war.
Yeah.
He drank whiskey, too much whiskey.
Yes.
And that was what happened when he had too much to drink. But he used to say to me, "Candy box for Kennedy Cox." So the teachers would tease me.
I was going to ask you, did you get much bullying from the other pupils?
There was a lot of bullying. There was a lot of bullying. I mean, unbelievable bullying. And the whole regime was, you're in a dormitory, hot water, wasn't running hot water, hot water was brought through in jugs in the morning. So it was cold.
Yeah.
You were beaten if you wet your bed. You were beaten if you talked after lights out.
Wow, yeah.
Physically beaten.
Yes.
See the headmaster, whack, whack, whack,
yes,
whack.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got beaten a lot, and I thought, this is unbelievable. I mean, really dreadful, and how can my parents do this to me?
And did your parents, or you never saw them from one term to another?
Almost not. Almost not. I mean, in the summer term, there would be a speech day when the parents there, whatever, they would be there, and you'd see them, and you might go out for tea and stuff. But it was really, really, really not like it is now.
No,
I'm not saying it's perfect now, but it's better.
Yes, it's a lot better.
Yeah.
Good heavens,
I was quite bright, and I was following in my nearest brother's footsteps. And I then went on to my next school, and I got into a fast stream. So I was doing O-levels very early, and A-levels very early.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had A-levels when I was 16, and I tried one college at Oxford.
Yeah.
And they said, come back in 2 years. And I said, no. I want to go. I'm ready to leave school. And I went to Paris. So I was 17. I went to Paris. And that was extraordinary because everybody else on the course I was on was 18 or 19.
Yeah.
So the girls weren't in the least bit interested in me.
No.
And the blokes weren't particularly interested in me and befriending me either. So
that's
when... Yeah. By that stage, we had a pub.
Yeah.
We had our own pub.
Yes.
My parents had a pub.
Your parents, you know,
and that was a cause of not good enough at my school.
Yes.
So at Malvern, while I was still there, there was a French master who would say, Monsieur l'auberge, Mr. Pub, in French. And then the guy sitting next door to me, his father had a soap factory.
Yeah.
So he would be Monsieur Le Savon.
Oh, yes.
So this Mr. Soap and Mr. Pug. So I was made to feel less than, not good enough.
Sure.
And when I got to Paris at age 17, again, I was an outsider.
Yeah, yeah.
And I found that, you know, a couple of glasses of red wine would take the edge off the day.
That's right.
And then if I saved all my allowance for Sunday, lived on bread and condensed milk mainly, I could go gambling. On the Sunday.
Oh, wow. Oh, yes.
So I developed two addictions.
Yes. Yeah.
And my parents had a pub. They drank and they gambled, but they didn't seem to have a problem with either.
No.
And I developed a problem with both.
Yeah. The reason I kind of reacted when you said you went to Paris at 17, I mean, I went to Paris at 16 and stayed there for a year, but not in a different, you know, I mean, I was playing and singing on the streets, but it was quite an adventure for me going there.
Oh, beautiful city.
Oh, wonderful.
Just stunningly beautiful.
Yes, yes.
And wonderful racing.
Yes.
Longchamp every Sunday.
Oh, you went to Longchamp?
Yeah, every Sunday.
So, yes, you as you say, you developed two addictions. So take us past there. What happened when Paris finished? What, you came back?
When Paris finished, I came back.
Yeah.
I hadn't bothered to take the exam at the end of the course to get a diploma.
No.
Because I thought, what am I going to do with this?
Yeah.
And I came back, and my mother, who was, I'm very like my mother, and I adored my parents.
Yes.
And my family was a good family, and there were no, you know, dramatic things going on.
Yeah.
You know, I can't point my finger at them and say it's all their fault.
No.
But my mother had really, really hoped that I'd get to university.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd tried this one college at Oxford and I'd been rejected.
Yeah.
And so her next thought was, you're not going to be the first person in our family ever to go to university, but you could be the first person in our family ever to be a professional.
Yes, to be a professional.
So she said to me,
How
about being an accountant?
Yeah.
And I said, Mum, honestly, you know, I'm quite good on working out odds, but I'm not interested in that. Well, how about a lawyer? So I said, oh, okay, that will do.
Yeah.
So then my godfather, Sir Reginald Kendley-Cox, got involved and said, oh, okay, I'll get you articled to a firm of solicitors.
Yeah, yeah.
I was articled to a firm of solicitors called Reed Sharman & Co.
Yeah.
He paid 500 guineas a year for me to be an article clerk.
Yes,
you got no money when you're there. It was like the privilege of sitting at the feet of a partner to learn the law. And I started failing exams for the first time in my life. And I started writing poetry. And I started drinking more.
Yes.
And I know I'm sounding like my father, but
yes,
a pint of bitter in those days in 1958.
I was saying late 50s,
was 10p.
Yes, that's
you
right.
You could have a pint of bitter for 10p. Yeah, so three pints of bitter would completely take the edge off the day.
Oh, yes.
At the same time, in 1958, the Labour government, surprisingly for a Methodist-backed organisation, introduced betting shops. Betting shops.
See, they came in.
That's when they came in.
Wow.
And they were seriously grotty in those days.
Yes.
They were intended to be like public lavatories.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you went in, you did your business, and you came out.
Yes, you didn't.
You didn't have a cup of coffee or sit or whatever. No. But so I would have my three pints of bitter at lunchtime.
Yeah.
Go and put some bets on to roll through the afternoon.
Yeah.
And that would get me through to the evening. Yeah. But I was failing exams. So that was what was going on.
It's a good time to. I mean, you love music, don't you?
I do love music. Yeah. I've got a tin ear, but I love music because I love lyrics.
Words. Sure. I might actually talk to you about that later, about lyrics, because I've got quite a few melodies, but I need lyrics. I'm not very good. Anyway, your three choices of music are very interesting, like they always are from interview, you know, people that come on the show. Now, you've chosen Danny Kaye for your first choice, haven't you?
I have.
Is there any reason for that?
I love the song. I love the thought. I wonder who's kissing her now. Yeah. I wonder who's teaching her how. I wonder who's buying the wine for lips that I used to call mine.
That's right.
This unbelievably romantic approach to songs came from my two brothers, my brother Bob and my brother George, but mainly my brother Bob. Yeah. And they played 78, you know, the old 78.
I remember the 78s. So I bought some,
and they had an A side and a B side.
Yeah, of course.
You know, that you could break them if you dropped them. And we had a wind-up gramophone.
And we had
songs by Bing Crosby, by Bob Hope, all kinds of people who've never heard of now. But Bing Crosby was one of the most famous ones.
Yeah, yeah.
And this particular song of Danny Kaye, I just thought was unbelievably sad.
Yes,
The thought of... somebody you love is now somebody else.
It's very sad.
And it just reminds me of those early days in the sort of, you know, late 40s,
most definitely.
Early 50s, before I got my own taste.
Okay. Well, thanks for that introduction. That's fascinating. And here's Danny Kaye to sing I Wonder Who's Kissing Her Now.
Who's kissing her now? I wonder who's teaching her how. I wonder who's looking into her eyes, breathing sighs, telling lies. I wonder who's buying the wine for lips that I used to call mine. I wonder if she ever tells him I wonder who's kissing her now.
Who's kissing her?
I wonder who's kissing her now.
Wonder who's teaching her.
Wonder who's teaching her how.
Who's looking into
buying the wine for lips that I used to call mine. I wonder if she kissing her now.
Oh, that was Danny Kaye singing I Wonder Who's Kissing Her Now. Yeah, it's fascinating lyrics. Would you like to say a bit more about that?
Well, yeah, I would actually, because it's my oldest brother, Bob.
Yeah.
And I have tragic news to tell you later, but I just want to deal with things as they were at that point.
Sure, yeah.
My oldest brother, Bob, was 17 or 18 years older than me.
Right.
And when the war started in 1939,
yes.
So I hadn't even been born.
No.
He decided he was going to join up. So he went to a recruiting office and they said, and he looked young. I look young. I used to look young, but he looked young.
Yeah.
And they said, sort of, how old are you, Sonny?
Mm.
And he said, I'm 17. And they said, I'm sorry, come back in a year.
Yeah.
So he didn't come back in a year. He went back home. He borrowed one of my dad's trilby hats. He stuck it on his head.
Yeah, yeah.
He put on a bit of style. He went to another recruiting office and they said, how old are you, sir?
Yeah.
And he said, I'm 18. And they said, sign here. And off he went to the war.
Right.
So he went off to the war, and I didn't see him until I was three or four years old. And he came back from the war.
Yeah.
And I loved my nearest brother, who I knew very well. And I knew my older sister, who was even older, a year or so older than him.
Yeah.
So there were four children. Wow. I was the youngest.
Yes. Yeah.
And there was this massive gap between the first two the last two.
Yeah, it's a big gap.
And I was the youngest of all, so I was completely spoiled.
Yes.
And he came back from the war, and he'd gone through the invasion from Africa up Italy.
Yeah.
And he'd been at Monte Cassino.
Yeah.
And he'd survived that. And they ended up in, he ended up in Salzburg.
Yeah, yeah.
And in Salzburg,
yeah,
this, whatever he then was, 20-year-old, whatever, had met an Austrian widow and fallen in love with her.
Right.
And he had a picture of her.
Yes.
And her husband had been killed in the war.
Yes.
And he was on the rock, different sides, but they'd fallen in love and they had a big love affair.
Yes.
His first big love affair.
Yes.
And I didn't hear much about it, but he showed me a picture.
Yeah.
And so that song, I Wonder Who's Kissing Her Now,
reminds you.
Was me thinking, I wonder, he wasn't asking me.
No.
I was wondering what was happening to this woman he'd been in love with.
That's right.
Because now he'd got a girlfriend who was in the farm next door to us in Dorset, called Ruby Coombs. And that's why that song is sort of quite significant to me.
I see.
It says a lot about an era.
It does.
Of my life.
Yeah. That's it. That's the aspect I love of music, one of the many aspects, but I love the aspect, how it touches people in unique individual ways, and it brings out a time for them, like you've just shared.
I love
that about music. Okay, so so where are we in your life story? Well,
we're just about to go to my next school.
What about the alcohol? It hadn't become a problem yet, had it?
No,
or gambling?
As far as I'm concerned, I'm not saying it wasn't a problem.
No,
but I'm just saying I didn't recognise it as a problem at all. I'm going back in time because I did a big jump from 17. I want to go back, if I may, to being 13.
Okay.
Going on to my next school, which is a private school, Malvern, on the Malvern Hills.
Right. Yeah.
And I was there, and I went in the summer term, and they had wonderful facilities, sort of squash courts and swimming pools. And like a holiday camp. I thought, this is all wonderful. And my brother had quite enjoyed it. I was following in his footsteps.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just ran up against even more overt snobbery than I had at my prep school.
Yeah, yeah.
Where I'd been, suffered bullying. I mean, not because I was different, but because bullying was part of the concept.
That's it, yeah.
And I go to my next school, and then I really run into snobbery. So people said to me things like, you mean your father's not the director of any companies?
Another
boy said to me, he said, Reg, I thought you were one of us.
Yeah.
But you're of the earth, earthy.
Wow.
So I was made to feel
good
enough. And I got into terrible trouble at school.
Yeah.
Although I did quite well academically. I didn't do well socially.
No.
And after I left, my housemaster said, this is the kind of person we do not wish to produce. And I thought of, I'll sue you, because I was doing law at that stage.
Sure, yeah.
But I didn't sue him. But I'm fascinated by, I'm obsessed with myself, so I'm fascinated by why I became a problem drinker.
Yes.
And part of the, part of the,
low self-esteem.
Part of the reason, I think, was the low self-esteem.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
and
right.
When I'd had a couple of drinks after I left school, I didn't give a, I didn't need a monkey's about anybody.
That's right.
It would just take the edge off it.
And
I'd, you know, I could go anywhere, do anything.
Sure.
Without it, I felt completely vulnerable.
Yeah, me, I identify with that totally, yeah. Well, let's move on up a bit. Well, let's move into your adulthood, you know, when you, and do you want to
give a summary I'm working away doing law, failing exams, turning up every day, having my 3 pints of bitter at lunchtime to take the edge off the day, doing my bets that run off, sometimes going to sleep in the office, which worried people.
Yeah.
Are you okay, Reg?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so I'm just having, thinking, you know,
but
not actually sleeping.
Yeah.
And failing exams. And then I finally, finally failed my finals. And I got a qualified pass in finals.
Yeah.
And then it became serious because it was like, well, you've got this far.
Yes.
You know, you got it. And I took the two exams again and failed them again. I took them again and failed them again. So I had a qualified pass. So I then did what in 12-step terms is a geographical. Not much of a geographical. I thought to myself, the problem is this firm of solicitors that I'm working with. If I go to another firm, perhaps I'll have a completely different experience. So I went to a firm of very bright commercial lawyers. So where I was doing mainly conveyancing and wills and, you know, domestic type stuff.
That's right.
There, it's like contracts.
Yes.
I was completely unqualified for it. They paid me as if I was qualified. They were very generous, but they expected delivery. And after 6 months, they said, this isn't working out. On your way. So I thought, my God, my career's in ruins already.
Yeah.
And I'm by now, I don't know, 24 years old.
Yeah.
So I read a thing in the Sunday Times, in Classifieds, I think, which it was vocational guidance.
Oh, yes, I remember that term.
15 guineas it was in those days. I remember it was in guineas.
Yes.
So £15 and 15 shillings.
Yeah, 15 shillings, yeah.
And it was psychometric testing.
Yes.
And I went off and I did this psychometric test. Answered all the questions. Thousands of questions. I came back a couple of weeks later for the debrief. And they said, well, Mr. Starkey, if you had come to us at 18, we would have told you never to go near the law. I said, oh, really? Why is that? He says, here is a profile of a successful lawyer. And here, and they had an acetate overlay. Here is an overlay of your profile. And you will see you're okay here, here, and here. But look at this. Your accounts are over here on the left, this central line. And they need to be over there. You'll never, ever succeed as a lawyer. So what do you recommend? So I said, if you come at 18, we'd have told you to be a journalist. You come to us at 24, you have a very high interest in money. We recommend you consider either public relations or advertising. So I thought, well, at least I know what, you know.
Direction,
So I went out and I thought, I'm going to go into advertising because I had one or two friends in advertising. And I thought, that will do. That's more my scene. Might be more my scene. And then I started getting rejected. I thought all I'd have to do is turn up and say, can I join anywhere? And they said, no. And I started doing, I said, I want to be a copywriter. And I started doing copy tests. And I remember doing a copy test for an agency called Ogilvy & Mather. And this strange woman, and I can't remember her name, and I'm not being discreet, I genuinely can't remember her name. I remember she smoked a pipe. And her great claim to fame was that she'd had an affair with Dylan Thomas.
These were
the bits of useless information that I knew about her, couldn't remember about her. But I did a copy test for her, and she wrote me a letter which was the worst letter I've ever received in many ways, because it said, dear Mr. Starkey, thank you for submitting the copy test. It is way above average. I thought, well, I've got a job. But it doesn't quite make it with us. And then it went on to say, you're using predictable adjectives with succulent steak, whatever it was. You know, there's no surprise.
No, that's right.
So I thought, well, I can, anyway. So I didn't get on, and I got a lot of rejection, and I thought, well, I didn't like it. You know, I didn't like it at all. So I probably did drink a little bit more to take the pain away and gamble a little bit more to take the pain away or to divert myself.
Yeah.
But I wasn't at all conscious of it being a problem. And so then, having not got a job, I discovered Watford College of Technology. Now it's South Hearts University or something. But it was then a college, a technical college, art and technology. And they ran a copywriting course. And I applied and I got a grant. And it was fabulous. It was like Paris in reverse.
Because
I'm now 24. I've got an old sports car. All the people on the course are 18, 19, including some lovely, lovely young women. And I have the most wonderful year. I come out top of the class because I should have done. I mean, to be fair, I'd had a lot of life experience.
Sure, of course.
You know, whatever. And I got a job straight away. I mean, well, I don't mean the first people I saw offered me a job, but with on my first round of trying to get a job, I got a job. And I worked with an agency called Kingsley Mountain and Palmer. And they were really bright and lovely and just fabulous. And I just thought, I'm in heaven. But on my very first day there, well, first of all, the senior writer who'd hired me, I turn up and he looks over his glasses and says, who are you? I said, I've come for the job, the copywriting job. You gave it to me. Oh, I don't know. I don't remember that, you know, kind of thing. And he drank. And the first decision was, where are we going for lunch? And we went to the Trattoria Terrazza in Romilly Street, four of us. And sat down, it was what we'd like to drink. Well, I don't know. What are you having? Well, I'm going to have a vodka and tonic, I'm having a gin and tonic. I'll have a gin and tonic. So, you know, and then the wine, and then the wine. And then in those days, you couldn't get a drink after 3 o'clock.
No, that's right.
Unless you went to a club. But they were members of the Colony Club. So we go to the Colony Club, which I'd never been to before, I'd never been to the trap before. And I'm walking in behind them, and whatever her name is, Muriel, who was the famous, you know, notoriously, you know, count lady there, said, oh, she's pretty, isn't she? And I'm looking around thinking there must be some bird behind us. And it's me they're talking about, because I did have hair in those days. Quite a pretty young face. And that was a new, whole new, I was at a different level. Alcohol was part of the scene. Provided you didn't upset clients, provided you didn't miss deadlines, provided you came up with ideas, you could behave very badly.
And did that set the scene for the rest of your working life?
It set the scene for the rest of my working life.
Both professionally as a copywriter, but also the drinking and the,
it was just part of the, it was how we do things around here. And it got work, you know, in a way worse and worse and worse. And I didn't, I didn't, I still didn't believe I had a problem.
Because
I was, in my terms, I was functioning. And, okay, I was, you know, I wasn't having blackouts. I was getting drunk. I would get quite unpleasant at times. But it seemed to be, it seemed to be okay.
Well, look, let's play your second choice. That maybe you weren't quite at the Heartbreak Hotel, but now you've chosen this because, well, it's the King, Elvis. And
Elvis was the first person that I feel I could, that I could adopt as a singer. Bing Crosby, fabulous, you know, baritone or whatever he is, and Danny Kaye and all these others, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. But it was when Bill Haley, and, you know, and when Elvis came in, I thought, this is unbelievably special. And
he was,
Heartbreak Hotel had Heartbreak Hotel on one side and had I Was the One on the other. I loved I Was the One as well, but I chose Heartbreak Hotel because to me it was, I'd never heard anything like it. I like the gloom. I do suffer with low-grade depression. The person who told me that, I said, even my depression is low grade. And she said, just be grateful. Just be grateful it isn't serious. And we can treat it.
Okay, well, here's Elvis with Heartbreak Hotel.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that Heartbreak Hotel where I'll be just so lonely, baby. Well, I'm so lonely. I'll be just so lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom. Be so, I'll be so lonely, baby. I'll be so lonely. I'll be so lonely, I'll make a die. Tears keep flowing, the desk clerk's dressed in black. Well, they've been so long on the street, they'll never, never look back. And think you're so, and think you're so lonely, baby. Well, they're so lonely, well, they're so lonely, and they could die. Well, if your baby leaves you, you've got a tale to tell. Well, just take a walk down the street to Heartbreak Hotel, where you will be. Could you be so lonely, baby? Well, you'll be lonely. You'll be so lonely, you could die. So lonely they could die.
Well, that was Elvis Presley with Heartbreak Hotel, and Reg, you know, the alcohol, there's a great line in some literature, recovery literature, you know, alcohol gave me the wings to fly but took away the sky, and it did in your case, didn't it?
It did. It did. I had my own agency by now. I was, alcohol was part of the problem. There were five of us. And we were allowed one aberration day a week each. Mm-hmm. So as long as all five of us didn't have it on the same day. So alcohol was part of the scene. Mm-hmm. And it became a problem. And somebody I was working with there, a copywriter, we went out to lunch, and she did the classic thing. She said, Reg, I love you, and I'm worried about you. And not only am I worried about you, I've got a solution for you. And this is absolutely the classical thing. And she said, I know a guy in Harley Street, and I'd like you to see him as a favour to me.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, God, you don't have another glass of wine. Can we just get off my back? It's not a problem. You know, I said, please, I'm asking you.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, I will. Because Harley Street appealed to me.
Yes.
My grandiosity, you know.
I think I know the person. He may be a guest on the show in the future. But you went to see him. And
I'm maintaining his anonymity.
Yeah, of course, of course.
And I went to see him. Now, I was going to tell a terrible story against him. And I was intrigued by the idea of going there. I remember thinking to myself, I have a beautiful wife, and she's going to Vida Sassoon to have her hair done, and I'm going to see some consultant in Holly Street to sort my drinking problem out, you know. And that's where it started. And to be fair to him, I did then do 2 years. He said, you can save money by going to meetings, which cost you nothing.
That's right.
And I've got myself a sponsor.
Yeah.
And for 2 years, I didn't have a drink. But I did have a problem.
Yes.
I said to myself, if I'm not having a drink, I cannot be powerless over alcohol.
No.
And I said to my sponsor, I'm going back for the blessing, not the curse.
Sure, yeah.
And he said, good luck.
Yeah,
anyway,
yeah.
I tried it.
Yeah.
And it didn't work.
No.
And I drank okay for about a week.
Ah.
And then after that week, I was back in, two or three bottles at lunchtime.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
And then on and on and on and on. And it did take away the sky.
Yeah.
And what happened to me was that my brothers, who I mentioned, my two brothers were killed in an air crash, and my sister-in-law. And I was on the phone to the crash site, and they were trying to identify their bodies.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was the most horrible thing I've ever experienced. And that's when I really, if I was drinking before, I was drinking with a vengeance then.
Yeah.
And I took it up to a new level.
Sure.
And then my sister, my eldest sister, adopted three children who'd been orphaned.
Mm.
And one day, a few years later, she's driving along,
yeah.
and a woman coming the other way has a heart attack, hits her car, kills her, almost kills the youngest son, youngest boy who she's adopted. So I've got excuses.
If you want an excuse, I've got excuses.
Yeah, I could say, of course, I was thrown into a private school system.
Yeah.
You know, my parents had a pub. I wasn't good enough. You know, and all my siblings were killed in ridiculously long odds against circumstances. Yeah. The tailplane fell off this aeroplane. It was a civil airliner flying from London to Salzburg, where my eldest brother was going back to see people he'd met at the end of the war.
Yeah.
And the tail fell off. I mean, the odds against all that happening are phenomenally high.
That's right.
So anyway, when I was doing my sessions in Harley Street, he said you can benefit by getting effectively free service with a 12-step fellowship. And I did that. I did 2 years without a drink.
Yeah.
I then started drinking again, and because I thought I could manage it, I couldn't. And now I haven't had a drink for the whole of this century. So
yes,
I'll be 19 years
19.
In October this year.
Oh, what October the what?
Just 26.
Ah, well, my recovery birthday is October the 27th.
How extraordinary.
So we'll celebrate. We'll celebrate.
No champagne.
we'll have a carrot juice or a coffee or a... Yeah.
That'll be lovely.
Oh, that's amazing.
I'd really love that. Really
that's
love
wonderful.
That. Yeah.
Well, out of all this, it's incredibly heartbreaking experience. It's incredible. And you've... we haven't got too long for you to actually, but you know, you've had nearly 20 years.
If I counted the other 2 years, but I don't count the other two years.
No.
I have had actually 20 years, over 20 years without a drink.
Yeah.
But I want them in a straight line.
But how's it been?
Well, it's life is difficult. And I went to Patmos where they go through all 12 steps.
Yes.
In a week. Yeah, and I freaked out there. And,
I
almost came back and started seriously drinking and seriously gambling again. The drinking has been pure. I mean, no drink.
Abstinent. Yeah.
But a total abstinence. But the gambling, I relapse on that from time to time.
Yes.
So that's probably my primary addiction.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm better than I was. And, you know, and I have had a psychic change because all my life, from my first days in advertising, I wanted to make a fortune.
Yeah.
And all I want to do now is make a living.
Yes.
So I'm doing things which help me make a living.
That's right.
They don't make me rich or famous.
No.
But they keep me interested. And and I have three children from two marriages, and they're a great source of joy to me.
Daughters, sons?
One daughter and two sons. Ten years between the sons.
Yes.
And I have a very good relationship with one of my ex-wives and a reasonable relationship with my other ex-wife.
Fantastic.
So that's all good.
Yeah, that is all good. And as I said at the beginning of the interview, Reg, you know, you always seem to be, to me anyway, kind of moving forward. The last time I spoke to you a few months ago, you were going to Barcelona, a place I love. Well, Montserrat, actually, the place where I ran recovery holidays 20 years ago. But you were going for a weekend workshop, weren't you?
Whole week.
It was a whole week.
Well, the workshop was 4 days, but I was there for a week.
And it's a very special place, isn't it? It's
stunningly wonderful.
It is.
It's so beautiful and such strange mountains.
Very strange mountains. And I ran recovery holidays in an arts centre in the shadow of Montserrat. It's such a special place.
It is.
Such a special place.
So, it's amazing how our paths kind of cross at different times.
Yes, but that was just one example. But you're always seeking and going on exploration, you know, of the soul. I love that. I mean, to some extent, that's been my quest, my journey, you know.
Well, I work for alternatives, and it's a bit like the film The Intern.
Yes.
Because my boss at alternatives is half my age.
All right.
And so I'm this old guy who's got a lot of experience, but actually I have to do very humble things.
Yeah.
Could you take this to the post office? Could you deliver these leaflets?
Yeah.
And somebody has to do it, and I'm the person. And and yet I get to do wonderful things, like, you know, Week in Montserrat is probably the best
thing
I've done. But I, you know, I do the humble things and sometimes the grand things, and it's lovely. And I don't get much money for it, but it's fine. But it's not dull.
That's it. And in fact, this very show today, Recovery Today on UK Health Radio, I mean, that didn't mean anything to me several months ago, but and I've always wanted to do a show like this. And you mentioned something, I don't know, probably a year ago first, and we met, and you mentioned a man called Johan. And anyway, it's a long story, but happy ending.
Yeah, wonderful. I'm thrilled. And I'm very proud of you, Jim. That, it doesn't sound patronising.
No, not at all. And well, it's been great, actually, listening to you share and, you know, looking at your life. It's been really a pleasure. And it's funny, we spoke about your last selection of music, because at first I thought, which is another brilliant song, it's called Yesterday When I Was Young. But your choice is Yesterday When the World Was Young.
That's right.
Which is a song I wasn't that familiar with, but I will definitely give it some listening after this. And various singers have done it.
Eartha Kitt's done a wonderful version of it.
Yeah.
And the lyrics are different. I mean, just the images are different for a woman than for a man. But it's a beautiful song about passing time, and nostalgia, and it's, you know, it's sad. It's a sad song.
But yeah.
And the issue, if I have an issue today, it's the thought that the best is over. And the best may be over, but what's here is good enough, is really my message.
That's fascinating. It's good, I mean, in the last couple of years, I've had quite an internal struggle psychologically with life. And not just because I was ill, but the illness, the medical issues facilitated it, you know, the exploration in, you know, my mortality and that, which started when I was, I think, when I was in my 40s. But I thought that, you know, I didn't think there was much to come, actually. But in the last few months, I've come through. There's a new dimension somewhere, and I do think there's, you know, I've got some good things coming up on the horizon. I'm sure we both have.
I'm optimistic we both have.
Yeah, I think we have, Reg. So thanks again, and wow, what a song to play out with. Do you want to introduce it?
Well, it's Frank Sinatra, and there are lots of, he's got an amazing singer, obviously, but there are some beautiful images there and some very, very sad images about, you know, it's great, but is it good enough?
Yeah.
And I'm here to say life is good. Life is good. Now is good. Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thanks, Reg. Here's Frank.
It isn't by chance I happen to be a boulevard deer, the toast of Paris. For over the noise, the talk and the smoke, I'm good for a laugh, a drink or a joke. I walk in a room, a party or ball. Come sit over here, somebody will call. A drink for monsieur, a drink for us all. But how many times I stop and recall. Are the apple trees blossoms in the breeze that we walked among, lying in the hay, game to play while the rounds were sung only yesterday? when the world was young. Wherever I go, they mention my name, and that in itself is some sort of fame. Come by for a drink, we're having a game. Wherever I go, I'm glad that I came. The talk is quite gay, the company's fine. There's laughter and lights and glamour and wine, and beautiful girls and some of them mine. But often my eyes see a different shine. Are the apple trees sunlit memories where the hammock swung on our backs we'd lie looking at the sky till the stars were strung. Only last July, when the
thank you for listening, everyone, and join me next time.
Here's the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a fellowship for anyone who has a drinking problem. The number is 0800 917 7650. That's 0800 917 7650. The number of Narcotics Anonymous, this is a fellowship for anyone who has a drug problem. That's from 10 a.m. till midnight. The number is 0300 999 1212. 0300 999 1212. And finally, Al-Anon, which is a fellowship to support family and friends of the alcoholic. It's from 10 a.m. till 10 p.m. The number is 0207 403 0888. That's 0207 403 0888.